No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God.
Hello, and welcome back to The Fear of God. It's a whole new year and a whole renewed Fear of God podcast. Find all your favorite foggy paraphernalia at thefearofgodpodcast.com. Every week here in the fog, we explore what scares us in order to find what saves us. And by we, I mean me, one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse.
And me, your other co-host, Reed Lackey.
Reed, welcome, brother.
Hey, man, how's it going?
I'm unattracted. You just keep cutting me off. Reed, listen.
Let me in.
This week, I know. That's what you do. Not only, Reed, are we jumping. I love, Reed, the about face I'm trying to make on you over time is that you're the interrupter. You know, like that is that's the going to be the legend of Fear of God.
Years of history disagree.
Yeah, exactly. It is you, the interrupter. Reed, this week, not only are we jumping back into our annual foray into the horror films of the previous year. Yes, I said horror, continuing today with Talk to Me, but also today we are joined by the foggiest of foggy friends, Mr. Matt Ruff and J.R. Foresteros. Gentlemen, welcome to the rock. No, to the fog. Welcome back. Matt, J.R., good to see you all.
Good to see you guys, too.
It's always great to be here, and I was not prepped for being on with Matt, so I'm having a hard time composing myself.
Well, Michael B. Jordan couldn't join us this time, Matt came in his stead, so it's all good. You can get a cocaine bear poster signed by him. all right. Listen, guys, Matt, JR, Reed, you can join us, too. It's time to go to our patron segment, where we have begun a TV guidepost run discussing Mike Flanagan's Netflix series, The Fall of the House of Usher. In this case, episode 5, The Telltale Heart. So sit tight, listeners, and we'll be right back.
So, about this movie, Talk to Me, y'all. Let me give a brief IMDb summary for this, just to get us started, and then we're going to dive right in. The IMDb summary of Talk to Me says, when a group of friends discover how to conjure spirits using an embalmed hand, they become hooked on the new thrill until one of them goes too far and unleashes terrifying supernatural forces. JR, I see that hand. Listeners don't have the benefit of knowing that JR, who regaled us with this on our Cocaine Bear episode, has an actual... My God, that looks so
awesome. It is awesome.
Where in the world did they get that? Oh my God, it's got the writing on it and everything. Is it a candle holder?
No, it is a bong.
Oh, it's a bong. Okay,
So you can see the right there... The finger in the front.
Yeah. Oh, makes
that
so much more sense.
Was
now.
In fact an unexpected response.
This is the official A24 licensed Talk to Me water pipe.
Water pipe. Okay, got it. Yeah.
Hey,
Lord.
Real quick, this is not about Talk to Me, but Reed, you just referenced Cocaine Bear. A 5-second interlude here. You know, Matt, JR was on a few weeks ago to cover Cocaine Bear. Since that time, Reed and JR, and Matt along for the ride here, I did visit for the first time the Canadian National Park of Banff, wherein we went on an excursion of a hike into Johnston Canyon, where bears were much the conversation. And I was able to share, you know, when they're black fight back, when they're brown lie down, you know, and I was like, these boys, I wish I'd had this experience before I talked about Cocaine Bear, but here I'm just sharing with you. I thought about you out in the freezing cold of that Johnson is awesome. Canyon,
Alberta. We'd love to hear it.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Okay. In the patron segment, I went first with Matt. JR, I'm coming to you first. Talk to me about your feelings and your experience about Talk to Me.
This was, I think, my number one horror movie last year. It kind of went back and forth with When Evil Lurks. Low budget, indie film, unknown actors.
Yeah.
And just really incredible. I actually wrote a piece for Tor.com, which is now Reactor. They rebranded Reactor. But I actually explored how I think this film sits in the tradition of possession films, but is also a uniquely Gen Z possession film. And so I kind of looked at, like, again, kind of used some monster theory to look at what possession films are actually doing culturally, and how, you know, so I took like The Exorcist, The Conjuring movies, and Talk to Me, and kind of did like, you know, boomer, I skipped Gen X because everyone does, millennial, and then, you know, the Gen Z. And I think this is kind of a next gen horror movie. It was made by next gen filmmakers. It has that very next gen sensibility. And it really, I think it showed what happens when you sort of decouple possession films from any sort of religious tradition. And you say, yeah, what would happen if a bunch of teens just sort of found this gateway to the mystical experience and had no guardrails in place, or had, you know, I guess they do have a couple of guardrails that then they ignore, as any good horror movie does, right? You ignore the rules and get punished. But yeah, it was so scary that I don't think you immediately recognize how smart it is. You know, until you're brave enough to go back and revisit it, and you're like, man, there's a lot happening in this movie that just worked really, really well.
That's awesome.
I did think the ending was a little bit confusing. But I would prefer that to having my hand held and having someone Google search and have some mysteriously maintained website spell out how the demons work.
Yes.
Certainly would take that. And again, I think upon subsequent watching, what's happening at the end becomes a little clearer. But yeah, like in the moment, I remember the film ending and being a little bit like, wait, okay, so who was that? How did that? Where were they? You know, but again, that just made me want to talk about it with all my friends once we caught our breath. So
yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. Matt, how did you come to this film, and how did you feel about it when you did?
So I had the good fortune to be invited to a preview of it, actually. One of the perks of, I guess, the lingering perks of Lovecraft Country is that I got on A24's list of people in the Seattle area you invite to previews of horror films. So my wife and I got to see Alex Garland's Men in the preview, and then I got invited to preview this, and Lisa took one look at the trailer and said, yeah, you have fun. And I really loved it. And then, you know, I watched it again today, and I was like, appreciated it even more. And I think it's, first of all, yeah, it's really tautly told. Like, there's no wasted space. It gets to the point right away. Every scene works. The acting is amazing, considering that the only person I recognized was Miranda Otto. But I think the thing that struck me on first watch, and again this time, that was just about it, is that all the kids in the movie, you know, they are all stupid and selfish and emotionally overwrought, but they're not wicked. I mean, it's like, they're just, in a word, they're adolescent. They are immature people dealing with something that they aren't grown up enough to understand exactly how dangerous it is. And I think the thing that made me laugh the most is the rules of the hand, where, you know, yeah, you got to do all this stuff to invite this thing to possess you. And then there's a 90 second time limit. It's like, you can't let them stay longer than 90 seconds, which is the part of this that, as an adult, I'm immediately like, how could that be a rule? That doesn't make any sense. It's like, if you tell me that the longer you're possessed, the more dangerous it is, that might make sense. But like 90 seconds, and you're, as long as you keep it under that, you're fine. It's like, that's like, you can't get pregnant the first time. That's a trap.
Right. Yes.
Don't I know?
kidding. that's something you heard from the friend of the friend who gave you this hand and told you sure. It wasn't that dangerous. And yeah, it's what I love about it is that the character study is just a perfect, it does a perfect job of capturing it in a bizarre, so supernatural way, but what it's like to be that age and think mm-hmm. you're invulnerable and I really enjoyed it. It's given what it is, it's really kind of wholesome in an odd way. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely very, very focused. Man, I'm loving this already. Nathan, I know where you saw it, but why don't you tell the story?
Well, I saw it in the theater in Charlotte, North Carolina with good buddy Reed Lackey, and Meredith Curran and Quarterly Queen Jess Fishley for the first go around, and we had a little mini convo about it around some margaritas in Mexican, which was very pleasant. And then rewatched it on a plane, actually on the way to said Canada trip. Now there's nothing like watching a movie like this on a plane. You turn the brightness way down on the screen. And at a certain point, you're like, whatever. My wife, it was really funny. I told her, cause on the way out, we inadvertently were in not sitting next to each other, just the way we ordered our booked our flights. And so I was like, man, I'm really nervous about watching this movie next to people. And she took a flight a few months ago and she's like, don't worry. On the last flight I was on, some woman next to me was reading erotica. So I think you're okay. You know, and it was like,
wow.
Okay. Well, whatever. You said so.
That's how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. win in Rome. For me personally right now, Talk to Me functions exceptionally as a horror film. Deeply frightening when it's supposed to be, deeply horrifying when it's supposed to be. Right now, even two viewings in, I get a little pushed out by the fact that I just don't care enough about Mia's trauma story. Wow. I mean, that's not me trying to be overly harsh. It's simply saying what I thought the movie was tracking changes into that. And I'm not as invested personally in it. And it left me wondering, I don't have a perfect fix for it. So I'm not even going to suggest necessarily anything at all. But, you know, there's part of me that wishes there was something different in that 30-minute segment there late in the film. And JR, you made a comment a minute ago that, you know, you use the word confusing. And this is why, let it be clear for the record, I literally just said this is an exceptional horror film and functions exceptionally in that realm. For me, I think it's confused by the end. I'm a little, or I am, and that's fair if that's the case. I think I'm pretty unclear. I don't need hyper explanatory, hold my hand, but the way Mia's mom gets used in the latter half of the film, it feels inconsistent if you follow it all the way through. I love the button of how it ends. I think that's clever, but I can't quite discern its consistency up to there. So for me right now, exceptional horror film, leaves me kind of scratching my head in some places besides that.
Fascinating. I love this movie. So for me, watched it, you know, you already said, like, we got the chance to watch it together, which was just super, super ton of fun. And then even just unpacking initial reactions afterwards. So when I came back into it, this is only my second time seeing it when I watched it in preparation for this. I think it was already commented by both JR and Matt about its economy of storytelling. So, so tightly constructed. I actually was gonna say definitively, exactly what you said, Matt, that like no scene is wasted. The only thing that, and maybe somebody can turn me on this one, but the only place where that hiccups for me in the movie is when they go visit Duckett's brother. And the only reason that hiccups for me is because nothing substantive really comes out of that they didn't already know. Like, they went back and talked to him, but nothing really emerges for that turns the narrative in any distinct way. After they have a very frustrating conversation with him, they come out, and they don't use any of what he's given them. Mia just says, well, why don't we try this? And then that spirals it next. And so, again, maybe I can be turned on that scene. But that scene excised, I'm so freaking impressed with just how economic the story is. We get right into the action. Opening scene is freaking galvanizing. So we get right into the action. We are introduced to the characters. And what I actually am still trying to feel my way through, maybe this conversation will emerge, is, and maybe this speaks a bit to what's been described as confusion. But for me, I'm tracking that it's very, very easy these days for film, for horror films that deal with someone who has lost a parent or lost a spouse to say like, oh, well, this is an examination of trauma and grief. I don't know entirely how zoned in on that specific aspect this film is. With the Mia character, yes, but it feels like there's some other interesting things going on in the periphery that inform that in a way that's not just easy to write off and say, oh, it's one more horror film about grief. Because I feel like there's an insidious nature to what Mia experiences that really captivated me. The ways in which she can't be trusted inside her own mind, and she certainly can't be trusted with what she's seeing. Case in point, witnessing the sort of bulbous lady coming forward to, you know, suck on the foot. And then...
That's a hell of a sentence, Lackey.
That's it. Welcome to the fear of God. So, but basically, right. like then when she wakes up, it's her, you know. So the film has a lot of interesting counterpoints where it's like, how much can we really trust her experience? How much can we really trust what she's seeing, what she knows, what she doesn't? And then in other places, it pivots very literally to where we'll see it through the eyes of another character. And I did find that kind of fascinating. That, for me, elevated it above, not that this is at all bad, but elevated it above simply one more horror film in a catalog about grief. All of that to say, I'm just tremendously impressed by it. I think it's a film that I don't own it as of right now, but it's a film I probably will own and could see myself revisiting multiple times over again because it's brief, tightly constructed. Look at that. Talk to me. Let me in.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah, sure.
Because I feel like what you're articulating is actually kind of what I bump up against, which is, and here's what I sort of hesitate to offer here, 'cause it's a bit malformed, but I was trying to figure out, okay, why am I not connecting in the second half of this movie? And I don't have a total answer there, except the reverse question is also interesting. What am I connecting to here? And y'all, I love and think the middle scene in the basement is one of the strongest in the whole film. So there's an argument that can be made. It kind of peaks there, but I think it's in that sequence. It's been a few days since I watched it. So forgive if I'm a little out of sequence here, but one of the finest thematic scenes for me is there's a scene in a basement, you know, much of these scenes with all the kids together take place in a basement of a sort. And there's some song playing, and it's just tracking everybody. It's a montage scene. Everybody's taking their turn. And for me, and I'm going to put this in the air, not as like, hey, what do y'all think about this necessarily? Because I know it, I'm not positive. I love it. But what would inadvertently tilt this towards message movie is, as someone with teenagers in my house right now, especially and specifically who are girls who are subject to all the things that are there. And as a person who keeps themselves pretty mindful of the technology space and all its promise and peril, through some of the things I, you know, listen to, read, all that sort of stuff. Like, the brilliance of this movie is its effort to take some weird ass hand statue and use it as this broken prism to assess the digital world we're living in right now. Like, to your point, JR, about this, I don't know if you said Generation Next, I don't know how you worded it, but that's what I'm remembering. But this concept that here's the horror for this era. And like any of the best horror of its of a particular generation, it's taking the mundane and the normal of that particular generation's life and just utterly perverting it. And so in this mode, it's the digital culture, it's the digital what have you. And so I think why I still kind of bump on, because I do think it decides to steer in to the trauma of Mia, and that part feels like the least interesting to me, to me, for me right now, in the things I do find interesting, and steers away from what at least what felt like the focus. It feels like it shifts focus to a thing I'm less interested in. And that's sort of just kind of articulating some of that in a way that, Reed, the way you were describing it made me understand a little more clearly that distinction.
Let me jump in with just a couple thoughts here. So first of all, the scene on the bus, there is something that we learn. It's just that they don't listen. He tells them very specifically, stop using it. The key to making everything better is to stop using it. It's like, and he'll get better. And the kids feel like they have to do something to undo what's happened. And he's basically telling them, no, you stop using it, it'll get better over time. And that seems to be true, because we see in the prologue, in the epilogue, that the kid eventually heals up. Obviously, he's going to be messed for life from doing that to himself. Sure. And then as far as Mia is concerned, yeah, it's not about her trauma. I think her trauma makes her the most vulnerable. The whole reason she volunteers to use the hand in the first scene, she's at the party, no one's paying attention, but they think she's weird. She does it to be the popular kid. And part of what screwed her up is, yes, her mother died, and her dad, with the best of intentions, like everyone else in this movie, like with the best of intentions, her dad didn't tell her the truth. And so she's been wrestling with this, and that just makes her especially vulnerable. And yeah, I resist sort of making the hand something that it isn't, but the obvious analogy to me was some kind of drug. And I guess you could also say, or the internet, or anything that kids get fascinated with without thinking about the downfalls or the pitfalls of it. And that's what it's about. It's about that peril, but she's the specific case because she's so at odds. That's what makes her vulnerable. And that what makes it impossible for her to let it go until it's too late. And I think once she kills her father, then it's,
Well, and there's a really interesting thing that you're brushing up against there, Matt, that like, and sincerely, helpful note about the bus scene there too. I was looking for something. I was like, man, I don't want there to be a scene in this movie I don't like. And now it's like, okay, yeah, now you've landed something for me. But something that I found interesting, now typically, you know, somewhere around here we would maybe pivot to a that ain't right, but I'm really loving kind of what we're scratching at. So if everybody's down, we can just sort of sit here for a minute. Something that I find really interesting about the way that the relationship with the hand and the ramifications when things go poorly is, and I'm gonna try my best. This could be clunky, so show me some grace if it is, and maybe help me get there. Like, there's this relationship, or I'll call it some tension, between what is a ramification of a choice and what's a deliberate choice. In other words, when the mom, and this bothered me even in the first viewing, and it bothered me in the second viewing, when Mia comes to check on Riley after Riley completely freaked out, the way they treat her as if she has done something deliberate. And that stood out to me, because they treat her as if, like, they ostracize her as if she has made a transgressive choice that she should have known better and should be held account for. Get out of here. You knew better. You did something that you... But what was interesting to me is the film seems constantly playing with the deliberate choice they make is not the same thing as the deceptive thing that they do. I'll point to when she kills her dad. She chose continually to keep him, to keep inviting this thing in. She chose to keep going and keep going and keep going. Did she mean to shove scissors in her dad's throat? No, she didn't do that deliberately. Yeah. But she did do something deliberately that the end result was an immediate outgrowth. And I find that fascinating, because in, you know, whether it be drug addiction, which I don't have really any direct personal stories dealing with drug addiction in any extensive degree, certainly not for myself or with close family members, maybe with social media to a degree and the internet and stuff like that. But there does seem to be this weird overlap between, well, what's the deliberate choice and therefore what you should be accountable for, and what's the, you got roped into a thing that became bigger than you and pulled you along into all of these. And I find that tension to be very fascinating. I don't know if that makes sense, or if I've articulated in a way that's clear. But that seemed to be what the film was interested in, to me, is that it seemed to be toying with the consequences for deliberate actions and the consequences for ramifications that you never could have expected from deliberate action. I'm going to hush and let some runway sit with that, if that's interesting to any of you.
Yeah, I mean, for me, so again, I kind of mentioned earlier that I was looking at Talk to Me kind of in the family tree of possession films, right?
Right. Yes.
And possession films have largely been like surprisingly conservative reactions to what is seen as an increasingly secular culture. So, you know, you take The Exorcist, which is based on a book, which is based on a real story. notably, when the book was published, the guy who wrote the book changed the gender of the child. I'm going to use scare quotes here for anyone who's unsure. The kid who famously was the real subject of the exorcisms was the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And they changed it to a girl for the book and kept it for a girl for the movie. And that film came out the book came out a few years after the pill was legalized, birth control.
And then
the film came out in the early 70s in the wake of the sexual revolution of the 60s that was kicked off by the legalization of the pill, I think in 1959, 1960. And in The Exorcist, you have a single mom and a daughter who is essentially going through puberty. If you sort of like make a list of Reagan symptoms and puberty symptoms, like, you know, weird fluids and being disrespectful to her parents and all that kind of stuff, right? Like, and the only solution here is a literal father coming into the home to, you know, to bring peace.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah.
And so again, this film like resonates on this deep level with a culture that's in turmoil because it's essentially trying to reinforce these very conservative patriarchal values, in a way, again, that's like so below the surface, right?
Sure.
You go to The Conjuring, and I think it's even more explicit because not only is James Wan a believer, but the Hayes brothers who wrote that movie are believers. And right. It literally, there's that scene early in the movie where, Ed Warren asks the dad if the girls are baptized. And he's like, we're not really religious. And he's like, well, we should probably fix that. Right. And then it ends with that quote from Ed Warren. That's like all but an evangelistic altar call, right? Where, sure. Like, so it's like super explicit. Like we're doing this to scare you to Jesus. Right.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is so interesting with Talk to Me is there is a wholesale lack of any thought about appealing to a authority of any kind to solve this problem. The boyfriend is a Christian. That's mentioned explicitly.
That's true. Yeah.
There's never a thought of like, well, maybe his youth pastor can help us or something like that, right? There's not even an appeal to like, let's go find a psychic, right? Some like non-traditional religious authority. There's no seeking that out at all. So actually the way I read the bus scene, I really like Matt's observation as well, is like this was the closest that they came to seeking out an authority who could tell them what they were doing wrong. Matt, to your point, right? Like he did. He's like, quit using it and it'll fix itself. And they were going, that can't be right.
You're right. That had occurred to me too, that was certainly what motivated. It's like, okay, let's track down the drug dealer and see if there's something you forgot to tell us. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But like, that's the closest they don't go to the police. Again, there are police in this movie, like extremely briefly. and it's like, it's just sort of understood that we don't want to talk to them. They're not going to help us, you know? And again, I think when you trace like our relationship with authority from the boomers who were like, you know, they were authority, right? Institutions were trustworthy. The church is the center of culture and all that kind of stuff through millennials where it's like, you have Ed Warren who's like, well, I'm not blessed by the church, but I guess I have to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and perform the exorcism anyway, which is like a very millennial, you know, like we'll be ex-evangelical or emergent or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you get to Talk to Me where it's just like not even a thing they think about because that's where you get to like Gen Z and later, there is no such thing as religious authority anymore. There's no idea. Yeah. So there's no framework to protect us from this like mysterious and dangerous world. And again, I think Talk to Me presents that as frightening, right? Mm. Like in the same way that the exorcism presented the decay of the nuclear family as frightening, Talk to Me is sort of accidentally portraying the lack of religious structures and institutions as frightening in a way that I'm not sure, given the track record of religious institutions with teenagers, is warranted.
Yeah. Now that is endlessly fascinating. I feel like, what would that train of thought say about the relationship between these malevolent entities and their desires for Mia? So is it, so here's something I'm trying to resolve for myself. Silly 90-second rule. She's under for like, what, 92 seconds, 95 seconds, whatever it is. And that's just enough that the film kind of leads you to believe like, okay, well, now they got their hooks in her. You know, she was just a bridge too far, and now they've got their hooks in her. Now, one of the readings that I have of the film is that these entities, whatever they are, good, bad, or indifferent, I think they're always after her. That's the sensibility that I get from the narrative, is that even though they do hideous and horrible things to Riley, that feels as if it is more broadly in service of their fascination with Mia. And I'm curious, JR, directly pivoting out of kind of what you're saying. So is it, Matt referenced earlier kind of this very hyper-traditional view of devil just wants souls because he wants to give the finger to God. You know, that's very, very sort of, this is the caricature of that specificity. But what do you see about the relationship between these entities and their desire for Mia, either in light of that cultural touch point or not?
So, yeah, I'm going to back up and say what sounds like a tangent, but I promise it relates.
Okay.
Matt pointed out how silly the 90-second rule is.
Sure.
I will point out, okay, so I am of the age, were any of you of the age where when you were at a high school party, you would make each other pass out?
Oh, no. I am of that age, but not of that culture. Okay. I did not participate. But
Nathan,
yes,
or Matt, is this something that's on your radar?
No, but I can think of equally stupid things that I did.
Right? Yeah. Like, so this was a thing. You would get someone to stand behind you, and you would hyperventilate, and then you would kind of like choke yourself, and then someone would squeeze you, and you would just pass out. You'd wake up on the floor. Everyone's laughing. It looked very similar to this hand thing. We all did it, and we all knew that it worked because we were cutting off oxygen to our brain, which, again, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to know that that's probably a bad idea. I almost said rocket scientist, but, you know, that proves the point. I did it too much, right? So I know, here's what I know. I know that there is no way that Mia is the first teenager to go past 90 seconds. There's just no way, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think Matt's point about Mia's vulnerability is really what's at the heart of the film. I don't think it's that she went 92 seconds and no one else did. I think the brother was probably the brother at the beginning of the movie. Was probably a similar kind of a thing, right? Like what made Mia vulnerable to them was her like naked need to be let in, right? Yeah. To belong. Mm. And so, again, I think what the film, if the film is trying to have a message at all, which I'm not sure that I think in a good way, it's not trying to do that. It's maybe warning about that desperate adolescent need to be liked and accepted and to be willing to do whatever. Cause it does leave you vulnerable to manipulation by all kinds of things.
Yeah. That's quite true.
Again, whether you believe in malevolent spirits or not, right?
Right.
And again, I think the best possession films kind of would work whether or not you think there's a real, you know, a real spirit at stake there. But certainly this one, like it's pretty clear what they're doing is unwise from the get go. In fact, one of my good friends, she has a hard time enjoying horror movies. Because she's like, well, I would walk into the room, I would see what's going on, and I would just turn around and leave. So like, I'm not even in the movie. And it's like, I was always like, I'm sorry, you were a smart teenager and I wasn't. I would have been the kid timing with the stopwatch and waiting for my turn in the chair. You know, like, I know that because I was that kid. So I think it's, again, I think it's a lot more about Mia's vulnerability and again, just how dangerous that is.
By the way, shout out to that actor, Zoe, I think Zoe Kazakis, or I forget his full name, or their full name, but the explainer of the rules in the film is a great actor. So,
And how about the fact that there is a at least non-binary, if not trans, character in this film that's just another character in the film? Just
Zoe Tarakis, the name.
Mm-hmm. And I think that actor is non-binary, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Again, they were just in the movie, and it wasn't part of the movie. Yeah. It was just, they're just in the movie. It's just another character, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Just there. No need to primarily highlight that, which, is something that I appreciate when that comes around. Inclusion without a spotlight is a path to normalization, which is, I think, is a good thing. This is firing a lot of cylinders in my brain, but I've already talked quite a bit. Nathan, you got anything to toss into the? It's your turn to grab the hand. I'll grab the stopwatch and.
Not. I'm like Jared's friend. Get me the F out of here. No, thank you. I think some pretty insightful notes there, tracking the sort of path of the exorcism genre, and just. You know, I'm as sort of despairing about that note, JR, of just the locked box these characters are in. And to your point, you don't need to believe in literalized versions of what a traditional moralism might point to, but just this, you know, that's the terror here, is there's nothing to appeal to, or the thing you decide to appeal to, you don't give enough credence to or pay enough attention to really find your way back out. I don't know. There's definitely a lot to think on there. I mean,
man, I feel bad because I don't want to dominate the conversation, especially when I feel probably everybody on this call is smarter than I am. But something else has stood out to me. I'm just like getting really eager and kind of bouncing in my seat a little bit. I'm going to enter into this part of the conversation as sensitively as I can, for reasons that'll be obvious in about 30 seconds. But another thing that the film seems to have on its mind, in a way that I received very well, I thought this felt like a mature way to handle this subject, and that's the subject of suicide. Because the reason I felt like it was a kind of a mature way to explore this kind of subject is hearkening back a little bit to what I was scratching at with the interest the film has between deliberate choices and compulsions that are beyond your deliberate choices. So a couple cases in point to kind of tie all this together. A central unanswered question Mia has is, did her mother do it on purpose or did she not? That's a central question that is hearkened to many times in conversations in the film. And that would be enough as it was. But then, what do the malevolent spirits do when they inhabit Riley? Every time he comes to, he tries to kill himself. They said that's a direct line in the film. Every time he comes to, he tries to kill himself. And it is known by all the people who know what has happened to him, it is known that's not him. Like, it's not that he was in distress or in despair. Something is driving and pushing him to behave that way. Even further to that, getting to the ending, Mia pushes his wheelchair down for what we believe right up until the moment is that she's going to push him out into the street. And then for reasons, and this is a little bit to your point, Nathan, about like maybe a confused moment or a confused transmission of exactly what happens there, what ultimately happens is, when it all comes down to it, it is Mia who throws herself out there under the influence of these malevolent spirits or not. We don't know. Maybe open to interpretation, but she throws herself out there. And the reason why I think I find that a mature exploration of a very, very sensitive subject is because of the tension when people discuss that, specifically the tragedy of suicide, the threat of suicide, the risk, the vulnerability, like we're talking about, of suicide. There feels like there's a lot of tension back and forth between that same concept, deliberate choice and compulsion. Mm-hmm. And the way those conflicting concepts around us trying to wrap our heads around that, the way that is a kind of a tug of war between those two. I thought this film was pretty smart to not hang, as we keep saying, a message button on it that passively dismisses it, but clearly is interested in some of these things that I think is a way to metaphorically kind of anchor yourself into a more mature and responsible conversation around that kind of subject.
One of the things I really liked about the movie, I think it's not trying to tell you what to think about it. It's not that it doesn't have anything to say. It's that it doesn't want it. There's no pre-planned message with this is what I want you to take away. It's like, let's tell a story about people acting the way they actually act.
Yes.
In this bizarre situation, and you can figure it out. And my read on Mia's death in the end, that was another example of being young, that some part of her knew that it's a mistake to kill Riley, but she couldn't just not do it.
Yeah.
She had to kill herself to stop it from happening. And she could have just chosen to, like, step back and face the consequences of having killed her father. But instead it's like, nope, I'm going to throw myself out there. And then this is one of the interesting lingering questions for me, is that I think it works that we don't really ever get into what JR was saying, that there is no overarching theology here. There are these malevolent spirits who, for whatever reason, are trying to mess with people. But are they devils? What are they? We don't really know, and the movie never gives a definitive answer. But the fact that Mia becomes one of them is kind of interesting, because that sort of gives you an out to think about, okay, does that mean she is now going to be trying to tempt people to destroy themselves too? And what would motivate her to do that? One thing could be, if you are stuck in this perpetual limbo and only ever get to come out for 30 seconds when people light a match, you'd probably become bored and somewhat jealous. And the malevolence might arise from that. It's just like you're really stuck in an eternal adolescence of, if I can't have any fun, well, I'm going to ruin you too. And that was just, I didn't really follow that train of thought very far, but that, yeah.
I'm thinking back to the Riley's friend at the beginning. Wasn't there something about that conversation that echoes along those same lines, where he's trying to get Riley to smoke, or he's like, he was peacock.
The whole thing, that's how they're introduced. The friend is like, yeah,
that's right,
is teasing him for not being cool enough to smoke, and that's part of what makes Riley want to do it.
That's an interesting observation that there's an adolescence about the spirits that's really interesting.
And it's fascinating to me too, the vulnerability that we keep brushing up against. And what's kind of interesting in light of what Matt just shared is, I don't know that I ever think about spirits, ghost stories, possession stories, anything. I don't know if I ever think about them as vulnerable, because we always think about vulnerability as a way of like, oh, can you be hurt? And clearly if you're dead, or if you are some, supernatural entity, well, clearly you can't be harmed, right? Except when you're defeated and put back in the box at the end with the magic, But not being glib any longer, like, I think what's interesting is there's usually a dismissal of like, well, malevolent spirits can't be vulnerable, but what if they can feel vulnerable? To Matt's point about the adolescence of them, like, they can't be vulnerable, but these spirits are kind of, if we are to take the very, very ending, the fact that Mia is lost in confusion, she doesn't know what's happening, she's chasing after her father in the elevator closes, all the lights are turning off, whatever, and then the first hand that reaches out to her from the darkness is the realization, oh, I'm one of them. And that's interesting that, like, okay, it doesn't necessarily matter if they can be harmed, if they can be hurt, if they are vulnerable. What matters is that they feel vulnerable and respond accordingly. And that's another fascinating thread, that it's like there's a certain sort of adolescent angst that even if they are completely safe in the moment, there's a compulsion to make foolhardy choices because you feel vulnerable, even if you are not actually vulnerable. And so you're going to make these kind of choices to feel more protected, even if you were never in really any danger until you actually tried to dispel your vulnerability. That's interesting.
Well, they're not in physical danger, but they're in horrendous psychological danger. I mean, it's literally,
yeah.
I mean, it's a vision of hell in a way. It's like you're permanently separated, except when you get these tantalizing moments of what you gave up. I could definitely see somebody wanting to bring other people in. So or wanting to stick around.
Yeah. Just have another moment of that. Like, give me those 90 seconds where I don't have to feel this anymore. And that's one of the things that really kind of scares me in a broader sense. I'm fascinated by it. I don't see the world this way, and I don't see what's beyond this world this way. But it is fascinating that the film posits an after reality that is full of torment. It is neither peaceful nor hopeful after all this is done. Many films have done this in different veins, but this film, I think, pretty definitively says, like, oh yeah, after it's done, like, that, this is what you have awaiting you, at least in the construct of this film, which is a pretty terrifying thought, even if you don't subscribe to it, even if you don't subscribe to the belief.
Go
ahead.
Maybe a minor jump scare here that Nathan's awake, but the something I cannot get out of my head, and you know, read maybe like last week, we'll end up just that in writing as a tie-off piece here, but
sure,
that hasn't really been mentioned yet, because I'm just absorbing all y'all are saying. I'm trying to weigh it against what clearly felt like some neutral thoughts when it comes to some of, you know, the thematics here, and trying to find my way in. But something that hasn't been mentioned that I can't stop thinking about is the kangaroo. And Reed, it conjured for me very directly the scene from The Invitation.
I thought the same thing. Yeah.
Which is a fantastic film. But I think something that's fascinating here, that JR, your articulation of the sort of God or godlessness of the universe of this film is, you know, that Reed, your even note about sort of the suicidal aspect of the movie, like our inability to sit in our own pain, our inability to know how to be comforted or seek comfort. And, you know, what's so fascinating to me about the kangaroo scene is, to me, it is a signpost of like, hey, I'm not going to explicitly tell you exactly what to think here, but in the overall, but watch what happens when we just stop paying attention to each other and stop, you know, we sometimes anthropomorphize things to even illustrate more directly our ability to overlook the pain of our fellow creatures. And even compounding upon that, this notion that if you want to look at the hand as this sort of port key, to use Potter language, of that is the access point. It is the nexus point in the film of the mystical realm. Whatever that mystical realm is, this is the access point of it. But even fascinatingly to me, in a way I hadn't given deep thought to, is like, it isn't just a hand, which is usually a thing extended in help and aid and comfort. It is a disembodied, dismembered hand. It is the absence. It is the negative space where help is typically present. And I don't know. There's something there to me that's fascinating and intriguing and you know, if I'm honest, kind of heartbreaking about it showing. And this is where, for me, I'll shut up about this particular point, where I still trip up a little bit on the focus on Mia in the late half, even though y'all have made a good case for it's her vulnerability that makes her easy prey. But in this notion of our willingness or not to pay attention to the pain around us. And how we aid others through their pain or not, that I just find pretty interesting, that to me, the kangaroo scene really represents well.
Well, and they definitely bookend it. Like, the kangaroo is present in that very beginning, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's not brought up again, except in passive reference right after it happened, until she sees it in the hallway before the choice with Riley. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to cut you off there. All you sparked there for me is the reminder of that symmetry. And this is what I was trying to say earlier about the looking glass, the broken, perverted prism that is this threshold they cross when they, the human characters in this, when they engage the hand, is when her vision is broken, she is now confusing helping Riley with putting him out of his misery. Which is what she couldn't do at the beginning. And that to me is the fascinating symmetry, is when we are ostensibly whole and yet still incapable of offering help, that then ourselves, our vision, our capacity, our intentions become broken and perverted, such that now we confuse helping with utter harm.
Yes. Yes. And confuse helping with merely an end of misery. Something I think about a lot is the way in which my compulsion as a father, as a husband, as a friend, my compulsion 9 times out of 10 is going to be to try to end the misery rather than provide support for the person to endure or navigate the misery. Mm-hmm. That's my tendency when I say I want to help is I want the misery to stop. Instead of being mature enough in myself to sit and stay with it and to say, no, maybe the support I could provide would be more of a boon to help this person learn how to navigate their pain that is never going away. But instead, my compulsion is like, well, let me just end the misery. And maybe that's not always the best thing for us. It's something I'm challenged by a lot in the way I try to be a better husband and a better father, is instead of just saying like, well, let me just fix this problem so this problem goes away, instead of being present in the moment and recognizing like, no, that's not helping anybody. it's not necessarily, depending on the situation, obviously. I'm not going to be like, nope, let the knife stay there and figure out how to get it out. within certain parameters and certain reasons, there are some things which teach us to learn how to be less vulnerable and feel less vulnerable. And that's not aided by us simply removing the threats and simply – that's not always aided by us just simply dispelling all the threats and let me just get to a safe space. Instead, there are some conditions – I'm not trying to be unilateral here, but there are some conditions where proper help would bolster our ability to navigate through that tension collectively better. Hopefully, I'm not just word salading here and that makes sense, but that's what's in my head.
Well, okay. Hang on. Because, gentlemen, we've been just waxing philosophical and talking about religion and theme and all this sort of high-minded gobbledygook. But lest we forget, we're a horror show. So, if it's gory, if it's gross, if it causes you a fright, what scares you about this movie? What makes you say, that ain't right?
Sure as hell ain't right. Do you want to do what we did before and just do, let's keep it to four? We're just
I'm throwing myself on my own sword here, and listening to our conversation about Evil Dead Rise, I was like, why did I do that? Why did I send us back for another cycle? No, the point is, that ain't right. You get one submission to the Sorting Hat, one and only one. This is your chance, gentlemen.
Ruthless brutality.
Yeah. I'm gonna be a generous host here, and I'm gonna start with Matt Ruff. This is your first time on this year, so I'm coming to you first, sir. Your that ain't right for this movie.
But the one for me, and it was even more so in the theater with the sound, with the big speakers, was Riley when Riley starts smashing his face against the moment when we realize in the most painful way possible just how dangerous a thing we've been messing around with. And yeah. that was, I mean, it's horrifying on the level of what he's doing to himself, but also in the back of your head, you're thinking about Mia's position. It's like, she's going to have to explain why she allowed this to happen. But mostly it's just the sound of that bone going, and he just doesn't stop.
And the eyeball. And then,
And the fear, I may have looked away and not even noticed that because it was just,
It's real bad.
I saw it today watching it again, but, and then the capper, his sister comes running in and tries to stop, and her hand in the way, and he smashes her hand too. And it's just like,
That scene is what I meant earlier when I said I'm worried the movie peaks right there in the middle. It's that. Yeah. It is so immediate. It is so jarring. It is so we were at 6 flirting with 7, and then we jumped to 20.
Yeah.
And it is alarming and upsetting, and oh my gosh, yes, absolutely. That ain't right. JR, what about you, sir?
I'm going to take that opening tracking shot that ends with the brother killing himself with the knife. That was shocking. The tracking shot was incredible, but then when the brother went, it just, whoa. Like, talk about setting a tone for this movie, telling us exactly what we're in for in the most disturbing way possible. What an opener.
Absolutely. Oof. Yeah. That's a way to start your movie.
I mean, the whole theater was like, it was
yes,
quite something.
Mm-hmm.
Reed, what about you?
Man, so many still on the table. Okay. It's been referenced in sort of, passive ways, but the death of Mia's dad. Not only the scene that preceded it, which is terrifying in that right sense, where distorted, burned flesh version of dad is kind of coming after her, which is scary enough, but you see it happening. The moment it's like, okay, she's wrestling or grappling with this spectral vision of her dad, but then it's smart. I think cuts to her dad outside where he's like, what's going on? So you already know, most films, I think, films have tricked us like that before, where the moment we realize that her dad's really in play is the moment that, she stabs him, and then that's happened. But this film, again, I feel smartly shows us the threat before we already know what's coming. We already know this is going to go very, very badly, but it shows us him concerned on the couch and then coming up and then, pounding on the door, trying to get in, so that when it finally comes to bear and she just scissors him right in the throat. Oh my God. It's devastating. Absolutely devastating. That's my, that ain't right.
I love it. Well, for my turn, it's going to be a new submission, but also a slight synthesis of a few that have been mentioned. So, what I want to, I think Matt, JR, y'all might know this. You might not, but in my vocational life, I am in the industry commonly referred to as sales. And I want to make a pitch to you here. So JR, you've got nearby this merchandise piece from A24, AKA your bong, that, represents, this hand imagery and statue from the film. I want to submit formally for you all here, which is the, merchandise line to come of the, Riley action figures, that
with
different heads. Don't you do it.
Okay.
This is my pitch here. Okay.
Okay. Wow.
So,
wow, bro.
There's going to be three versions. Okay. One is, as Matt already alluded to, there's headbanging Riley, comes from his own dad. He's got maybe a little tag in his back that when you hit it, he just slaps his head.
Wrong lever.
Why do we even have that lever? So there's headbanging Riley, smacking his face, and once you do it once, the eyeball pops out, and then you reset.
Oh my God.
Kind of do it all over again. And then I'm gonna cut to the least action packed one, and come back around. This is not in sequence of the film. So jumping ahead later in the film, you've got bedtime Riley. Now that sounds real, you know, kind of just pastoral and lovely, but it is absolutely not that. He is laid up, he is banged up, he is shackled up, you know, it's just, I don't know exactly how you're going to play with bedtime Riley, but you know, I don't know, wheel him around as a kind of prop for your nurse Barbie or something. I don't know.
It's a really crappy toy.
But you got to have all of them in order to have the complete set.
It's like a Pokemon. You got to catch all the rides.
Yeah. Yeah. The last one, there's a lot of action built into this one. That is bath time Riley. Okay.
Oh my God.
Bath time Riley.
Mm-mm. That ain't right.
Okay. It's not right. I know. That's right. The segment, and this is the pitch. He's, you know, he starts in a wheelchair where the back of the wheelchair has a thing that launches him out onto the ground. And you know, those old sort of action figure play sets that have breakaway walls and stuff, you know, you could trigger it. It breaks the tile behind him.
It's got battle damage.
Right. Oh yes, he does. significant battle damage. But one of the last features that comes with this specific Riley is the blood water lapping action. Yep. That.
Importantly, though, while he's still making eye contact with you.
Oh, yes. He's like, you like this?
If you look real closely, that eyeball, you know, it's all swollen and nasty, but it's looking right at you. And just going,
it's clear this is a performance, right?
So yeah, I just wanted to submit that, you know, if there's any, you know, kind of anyone with NECA or maybe Hasbro, that might be a little aggressive for them, but you know, A24, hit me up, you know, I'm happy to, you know, we'll get Jacob Hunt to do up some designs for us, Reed. And
I think just, A24 just did Iron Claw action figures. So, you know, they've already figured it out, right?
Yep. Uh-huh. Oh man.
And that has been let me find my outro here. Did you squirm? Yes. Did you wince? A hell of a lot. Did you on live podcast make Matt Ruff, author, squirm, wince, and squint his eyes real tight? Yes. It was probably because of what we around here call that ain't right.
That sure as hell ain't right.
Oh, that ain't right. Ain't well played, right. Sir. Oh, man. Well, listen, we
kind of
changed.
That's the idea, Matt. Well played with the Riley action
figures. No, you can sell two of those. And it's gonna
I'll
be
buy
it.
One.
Can you do it?
I'm sure you would.
He's like, it goes right there with a the hand. So, listen, we've already had a pretty substantive conversation, so we'll kind of pivot from that ain't right into the fog meter, if that's okay with everybody. Everybody sure. Good if we do that? So the fog meter is our specific, show-specific metric where we rate the media that we cover on fear and God, which measures not necessarily the quality of the film, but its gravity, its heft, what it asks of you as the viewer. And we rate those, as I said, on fear and God, which is the kind of the frights, the scares, the gruesomes, and the substance, or well, you know, what the film has on its mind and how well it kind of explores or articulates that vision. Okay, so changing things up a little bit, Nathan, I'm gonna start with you. Why don't you give me your...
Is that because Nathan hated it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we're going to end on some high notes. Yeah, so end on some high notes.
You know? I feel like I'm trying to reach out for a hand, and what I'm drawing back is some dismembered, disfigured, you know,
the Cocaine Bear episode.
That is, man. You're gonna begin to believe Nathan didn't like horror movies.
Speaking of vulnerability. Feeling raw up in here.
But no, sincerely.
I'm like that kangaroo, and y'all are just like driving right on by.
Just listen, but at least you have some new toys to play with when you
Somebody
are.
Somebody will. Hey, that's a killer idea.
It is. Meter. So yeah, fear and God. Hit me with them. Both numbers, Nathan.
I mean, like I said an hour ago, and I still hold to, it's a hell of a horror movie. In ways few of its immediate peers do, it delivers in spades here. I'm going to give an 8.5 for the old fear meter.
All right. I see you.
On the God slide, on the old God meter, I am right now going to go for a 7. I know that it's thoughtful I am still not quite at the harmonization you all have arrived at for its consistency, but I do see a there, and I'm walking towards it. It's a little dark. I'm walking towards it, but I see a little flick of light, and I'm going to go figure out what the hell's going on. Oh God. And here all of you are.
You're speaking Greek, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Indeed. Okay. JR, you're up next. Why don't you go ahead and give me both measurements, fear and God.
I'm going to give it a 10 and an 8.
All right. I like that.
I think this is one of the scariest movies of all time. I think it's going to be, I think it's an, I hate to say it, instant classic. It's super, super, super scary. I think it deserves all the accolades it's gotten. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Nathan. I've said that I thought it was a little confused towards the end. I'm not, you know, these were first time filmmakers. They're big YouTube, channel. They have a big YouTube channel, right? But first time feature. And I just wonder if they had made this film, you know, three or four movies down the road, if it wouldn't have been a little bit clearer what they had in mind, you know, for the kind of coherence of what was going on at the end. Because again, I think it does become clear after multiple rewatches, but not in a way that I think was a sign of a great film, you know. So mm-hmm. again, I'm going to say probably more like a 8 in there, not very far off from Nathan in that regard. So
okay. Yeah. Totally cool. Matt, what would you give it? Go ahead and give me both measurements.
I think I'm gonna go with JR on this one. 10 and 8 sounds fair. It was definitely on my top list of top horror movies of the year it came out. I guess it was it last year or the year before?
Because last year.
IMDb said 2022, but it didn't seem right to me. Maybe
because it came out to it. Well, I think it did play festivals before A24.
Okay, that's probably what that happened. It was last year. Okay, so yeah.
So I think it did. You know, very, very. That's like it's going to happen again this year. It happens every single year. But side tangent, a film I'm very, very eager to see called Late Night with the Devil that was all a buzz in the festival circuit, but it's releasing officially widely later this year. So it's going to be counted for this year, even though, you know, ran the festival circuit last year. Okay. So yeah, I'm not too far off from you guys. I'm not quite going to join you with the 10 and the 8, but I will be close, and I'm going to land at a 9 and a 7. So for me, the fear is so strong. I didn't highlight this during our That Ain't Right, but so many of my That Ain't Right notes were followed by the word spelled out, like with multiple, like or something like oof, after nearly every single That Ain't Right note that
Reed
I had.
Was on the toilet watching the movie this time.
listen, talk to me.
Airplanes are kind of fancy.
That's right. I think I really will just endlessly applaud this film's economy, its craft, and as exhibited by several of the things we talked about, I think it's ripe with a ton of conversation points and things to think about and things to explore. We've all kind of said it as a compliment that it doesn't... this is a little ironic. It doesn't do any hand holding, except the literal hand holding that they do in the film. But I think to a degree that inhibits a little bit of its clarity. I think it throws the doors wide open for thoughtful exploration, but inhibits a little bit of what you can walk away with and really sort of sink your teeth into as something to think about or anchor into. So yeah, that is a 9 and a 7 for me, and that means that we give Talk to Me. Oh, this is always this tension point, because we give it 8.5 is what we give it, but we can round that up to a 9. Yeah, we're going to round that up to a 9 for Talk to Me. So 9 out of 10 for Talk to Me on the fog meter. And I think it's fairly safe to say, even lumping Nathan in, that we'd all recommend people see it, right? I mean, got to have a strong stomach, but yeah, like we'd recommend people see it.
No. Don't bring the talk kids. To me.
defiantly. Nathan's like, screw you guys. Oh my gosh. Well, guys, I have had just such a fantastic time visiting with you all again. It's just been so great. Listeners, we hope you've had half the fun that we've had. Matt, thank you so much. It's always such a good time. JR, thank you so much. Really, really strong pleasure to have you here again.
And nice meeting you, JR.
Likewise, yeah. Matt. It's such an honor.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm glad we could make that connection for you guys. Next week, we are going to, as we've been wont to do, we're sort of bouncing back and forth between tones and different kinds. This is a pretty dynamic year. But next week we're going to something decidedly more upbeat and decidedly more sort of broadly optimistic. We're going to Totally Killer next week. It's a film that dropped to streaming platforms and has a very 80s sensibility. It's kind of like Back to the Future if it were a horror movie. So Totally Killer next week. And also for the patrons, I will remind you again, and Nathan, I will drop you multiple notes. The episode you're going to watch is episode 6. That's the easy part. But episode 6 is called The Gold Bug of the Fall of the House of Usher. If you want to read the story that inspired it, read the story William Wilson. So next week...
You said read Gold Bug for Gold Bug?
Oh, dear Lord. You're going to confuse yourself. See, that's what's going to happen.
It's the name of the episode, Nathan. It should be easy.
Yeah, exactly. You're just gonna joke God. Yourself in to be like, I'm going to show up next week. And he's going to be like, I wasn't supposed to read... Oh my gosh. So yeah, next week, Totally Killer and episode 6 of Fall of the House of Usher and the story William Wilson. And as we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. So in that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. Gentlemen, thank you all again. Always a pleasure. We will see you all next week.
The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media and episode archive, essays, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast, where you will unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online events, and so much more. Special thanks to Jacob Hunt of TracerMatula.com for our artwork. Our assortment of talented musicians, Andrew Nelson, the Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes. And to Lee Wright and Reed Lackey for our theme music. Special thank you also to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice. And if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.